American history textbook, in this case, American Adventures. Since the incident probably never happened, including it in a textbook is hard to defend. One way to understand its inclusion is by examining what it does in the narrative. The incident is melodramatic. It creates a mild air of suspense, even though we can be sure, of course, that everything will turn out all right in the end. Surely the passage encourages identification with Columbus's enterprise, makes Columbus the underdog, riding a mule, shabby of cloak, and places us on his side. The second passage was recorded by Las Casas, who apparently learned it from Arawak's on Cuba. Unlike the mule story, the cacique's story teaches important facts, that the Spanish sought gold and that they killed Indians, that Indians fled and resisted. Indeed, after futile attempts at armed resistance on Cuba, this cacique fled into the brambles. Weeks later, when the Spanish captured him, they burned him alive. Nonetheless, no history textbook includes the cacique's story. Doing so might enable us to identify with the Indian side. By avoiding the names and stories of individual Arawaks and omitting their points of view, authors otherize the Indians. Readers need not concern themselves with the Indians' ghastly fate, for Indians never appear as recognizable human beings. Textbooks themselves, it seems, practice cognitive dissonance. Excluding the second passage, and including the first passage, excluding the probably true, and including the improbable, amounts to colonialist history. This is the Columbus story that has dominated American history books. All around the globe, however, the nations that were discovered, conquered, civilized, and colonized by European powers are now independent, at least politically. Europeans and European Americans no longer dictate to them as master to native, and therefore need to stop thinking of themselves as superior, morally and technologically. A new and more accurate history of Columbus could assist this transformation. Of course, this new history must not judge Columbus by standards from our own time. In 1493, the world had not decided, for instance, that slavery was wrong. Some Indian nations enslaved other Indians. Africans enslaved other Africans. Europeans enslaved other Europeans. To attack Columbus for doing what everyone else did would be unreasonable. However, some Spaniards of the time, Bartolomé de las Casas, for example, opposed the slavery, land-grabbing, and forced labor that Columbus introduced on Haiti. Las Casas began as an adventurer and became a plantation owner. Then he switched sides, freed his Indians, and became a priest who fought desperately for humane treatment of the Indians. When Columbus and other Europeans argued that Indians were inferior, Las Casas pointed out that Indians were sentient human beings, just like anyone else. When other historians tried to overlook or defend the Indian slave trade begun by Columbus, Las Casas denounced it as among the most unpardonable offenses ever committed against God and mankind. He helped prompt Spain to enact laws against Indian slavery, although these laws came too late to help the Arawaks and were often disregarded, they did help some Indians survive. Centuries after his death, Las Casas was still influencing history. Simón Bolívar used Las Casas's writings to justify the revolutions between 1810 and 1830 that liberated Latin America from Spanish domination. When history textbooks leave out the Arawaks, they offend Native Americans. When they omit the possibility of African and Phoenician precursors to Columbus, they offend African Americans. When they glamorize explorers such as De Soto just because they were white, our histories offend all people of color. When they leave out Las Casas, they omit an interesting idealist with whom we might all identify. When they glorify Columbus, our textbooks prod us toward identifying with the oppressor. When textbook authors omit the causes and process of European world domination, they offer us a history whose purpose must be to keep us unaware of the important questions. Perhaps, worst of all, when textbooks paint simplistic portraits of pious, heroic Columbus, they provide feel-good history that bores everyone. Chapter 3. The Truth About the First Thanksgiving. Considering that virtually none of the standard fare surrounding Thanksgiving contains an ounce of authenticity, historical accuracy, or cross-cultural perception, why is it so apparently ingrained? Is it necessary to the American psyche to perpetually exploit and debase its victims in order to justify its history? Michael Doris. European explorers and invaders discovered an inhabited land. Had it been pristine wilderness, then, it would possibly be so still. For neither the technology nor the social organization of Europe in the 16th and 17th centuries had the capacity to maintain, of its own resources, outpost colonies thousands of miles from home. Francis Jennings. Europeans were able to conquer America not because of their military genius, or their religious motivation, or their ambition, or their greed. They conquered it by waging unpremeditated biological warfare. Howard Simpson. It is painful to advert to these things, but our forefathers, though wise, pious, and sincere, were nevertheless, in respect to Christian charity, under a cloud. And in history, truth should be held sacred at whatever cost, especially against the narrow and futile patriotism, which instead of pressing forward in pursuit of truth, takes pride in walking backwards to cover the slightest nakedness of our forefathers. Colonel Thomas Aspinwall. Over the past few years, I have asked hundreds of college students, when was the country we now know as the United States first settled? This is a generous way of phrasing the question. Surely we now know as implies that the original settlement antedated the founding of the United States. I initially believed, certainly I had hoped, that students would suggest 30,000 B.C. or some other pre-Columbian date. They did not. Their consensus answer was 1620. Obviously, my students' heads had been filled with America's origin myth, the story of the first Thanksgiving. Textbooks are among the retailers of this primal legend. Part of the problem is the word settle. Settlers were white, a student once pointed out to me. Indians didn't settle. Students are not the only people misled by settle. The film that introduces visitors to Plymouth Plantation tells how they went about the work of civilizing a hostile wilderness. One recent Thanksgiving weekend, I listened as a guide at the Statue of Liberty talked about European immigrants populating a wild East Coast. As we shall see, however, if Indians hadn't already settled New England, Europeans would have had a much tougher job of it. Starting the story of America's settlement with the Pilgrims leaves out not only the Indians, but also the Spanish, the very first non-native settlers in the country we now know as the United States, were African slaves left in South Carolina in 1526 by Spaniards, who abandoned a settlement attempt. In 1565, the Spanish massacred the French Protestants who had settled briefly at St. Augustine, Florida, and established their own fort there. Some later Spanish settlers were our first Pilgrims, seeking regions new to them to secure religious liberty. These were Spanish Jews, who settled in New Mexico in the late 1500s. Few Americans know that one-third of the United States, from San Francisco to Arkansas to Natchez to Florida, has been Spanish longer than it has been American, and that Hispanic Americans lived here before the first ancestors of the Daughters of the American Revolution ever left England. Moreover, Spanish culture left an indelible mark on the American West. The Spanish introduced horses, cattle, sheep, pigs, and the basic elements of cowboy culture, including its vocabulary: Mustang, Bronco, Rodeo, Lariat, and so on. Horses that escaped from the Spanish and propagated triggered the rapid flowering of a new culture among the Plains Indians. "How refreshing it would be," wrote James Axtell, "to find a textbook that began on the West Coast before treating the traditional Eastern colonies." Beginning the story in 1620 also omits the Dutch, who were living in what is now Albany by 1614. Indeed, 1620 is not even the date of the first permanent British settlement, for in 1607 the London Company sent settlers to Jamestown, Virginia. No matter. The mythic origin of the country we now know as the United States is at Plymouth Rock, and the year is 1620. Here is a representative account from the American tradition. After some exploring, the Pilgrims chose the land around Plymouth Harbor for their settlement. Unfortunately, they had arrived in December and were not prepared for the New England winter. However, they were aided by friendly Indians, who gave them food and showed them how to grow corn. When warm weather came, the colonists planted, fished, hunted, and prepared themselves for the next winter. After harvesting their first crop, they and their Indian friends celebrated the first Thanksgiving. My students also remember that the Pilgrims had been persecuted in England for their religious beliefs, so they had moved to Holland. They sailed on the Mayflower to America and wrote the Mayflower Compact, the forerunner to our Constitution, according to my students. Times were rough until they met Squanto, who taught them how to put a small fish as fertilizer in each little corn hill, ensuring a bountiful harvest. But when I asked my students about the plague, they just stare back at me. "What plague? The Black Plague?" "No," I sigh. "That was 3 centuries earlier." The Black Plague does provide a useful introduction, however. William Longer has written that the Black, or Bubonic Plague, was undoubtedly the worst disaster that has ever befallen mankind. In the years 1348 through 1350, it killed perhaps 30% of the population of Europe. Catastrophic as it was, the disease itself comprised only part of the horror. According to Langer, "almost everyone in that medieval time interpreted the plague as a punishment by God for human sins. Thinking the day of judgment was imminent, farmers didn't plant crops. Many people gave themselves over to alcohol. Civil and economic disruption may have caused as much death as the disease itself. The entire culture of Europe was affected. Fear, death, and guilt became prime artistic motifs. Milder plagues, typhus, syphilis, and influenza, as well as bubonic, continued to ravage Europe until the end of the 17th century. The warmer parts of Europe, Asia, and Africa have historically been the breeding ground for most of mankind's illnesses. Humans evolved in tropical regions. Tropical diseases evolved alongside them. People moved to cooler climates only with the aid of cultural inventions, clothing, shelter, and fire, that helped maintain warm temperatures around their bodies. Microbes that live outside their human hosts during part of their life cycle had trouble coping with Northern Europe and Asia. When humans migrated to the Americas across the newly drained Bering Strait, if the archaeological consensus is correct, the changes in climate and physical circumstance threatened even those hardy parasites that had survived the earlier slow migration northward from Africa. These first immigrants entered the Americas through a frigid decontamination chamber. The first settlers in the Western Hemisphere thus probably arrived in a healthier condition than most people on Earth have enjoyed before or since. Many of the diseases that had long shadowed them simply couldn't survive the journey. Neither did some animals. People in the Western Hemisphere had no cows, pigs, horses, sheep, goats, or chickens before the arrival of Europeans and Africans after 1492. many diseases from anthrax to tuberculosis, cholera to streptococcus, ringworm to various poxes, are passed back and forth between humans and livestock. Since early inhabitants of the Western Hemisphere had no livestock, they caught no diseases from them. Europe and Asia were also made unhealthy by a subtler factor, social density. Organisms that cause disease need a constant supply of new hosts for their own survival. This requirement is nowhere clearer than in the case of smallpox, which can't survive outside a human body. But, in its enthusiasm, the organism often kills its host. Thus, the pestilence creates its own predicament. It requires new victims at regular intervals. The various influenza viruses must likewise move on, for if their victims survive, they enjoy a period of immunity lasting at least a few weeks, and sometimes a lifetime. Small-scale societies like the Paiute Indians of Nevada, living in isolated, nuclear, and extended families, could and did suffer post-Columbian smallpox epidemics, transmitted to them by more urban neighbors. But they could not sustain such an organism over time. Even Indians living in villages didn't experience sufficient social density. Villagers might encounter 300 people each day, but these would usually be the same 300 people. Coming into repeated contact with the same few others doesn't have the same consequences as meeting new people, either for human culture or for culturing microbes. Some areas in the Americas did have high social density. Incan roads connected towns from northern Ecuador to Chile. 1,500 to 2,000 years ago, the population of Cahokia, Illinois, numbered about 40,000. Trade linked the Great Lakes to Florida, the Rockies to what is now New England. We are therefore not dealing with isolated bands of primitive peoples. Nonetheless, most of the Western Hemisphere lacked the social density found in much of Europe, Africa, and Asia. And nowhere in the Western Hemisphere were there sinkholes of sickness like London or Cairo, with raw sewage running in the streets. The scarcity of disease in the Americas was also partly attributable to the basic hygiene practiced by the region's inhabitants. Residents of Northern Europe and England rarely bathed, believing it unhealthy, and rarely removed all of their clothing at one time, believing it immodest. The pilgrims smelled bad to the Indians. Squanto tried without success to teach them to bathe, according to Phinney Ziner, his biographer. For all these reasons, the inhabitants of North and South America, like Australian Aborigines and the peoples of the far-flung Pacific Islands, were a remarkably healthy race before Columbus. Ironically, their very health proved their undoing, for they had built up no resistance, genetically or through childhood diseases, to the microbes that Europeans and Africans would bring to them. In 1617, just before the pilgrims landed, the process started in southern New England. For decades, British and French fishermen had fished off the Massachusetts coast. After filling their hulls with cod, they would go ashore to lay in firewood and fresh water, and perhaps capture a few Indians to sell into slavery in Europe. It's likely that these fishermen transmitted some illness to the people they met. The plague that ensued made the Black Death pale by comparison. Some historians think the disease was the bubonic plague. Others suggest that it was viral hepatitis, smallpox, chickenpox, or influenza. Within 3 years, the plague wiped out between 90 and 96% of the inhabitants of coastal New England. The Indian societies lay devastated. "Only the 20th person is scarce left alive," wrote Robert Cushman, a British eyewitness, recording a death rate unknown in all previous human experience. Unable to cope with so many corpses, the survivors abandoned their villages and fled, often to a neighboring tribe. Because they carried the infestation with them, Indians died who had never encountered a white person. Howard Simpson describes what the pilgrims saw. Villagers lay in ruins because there was no one to tend to them. The ground was strewn with the skulls and the bones of thousands of Indians who had died, and none was left to bury them. During the next 15 years, additional epidemics, most of which we know to have been smallpox, struck repeatedly. European Americans also contracted smallpox and other maladies, to be sure, but they usually recovered, including, in a later century, the heavily pockmarked George Washington. Native Americans usually died. The impact of the epidemics on the two cultures was profound. The English separatists, already seeing their lives as part of a divinely inspired morality play, found it easy to infer that God was on their side. John Winthrop, governor of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, called the plague miraculous. In 1634, he wrote to a friend in England, "But for the natives in these parts, God hath so pursued them, as for 300 miles space the greatest part of them are swept away by the smallpox, which still continues among them. So as God hath thereby cleared our title to this place, those who remain in these parts, being in all not 50, have put themselves under our protection." God, the original real estate agent. Many Indians likewise inferred that their God had abandoned them. Robert Cushman reported that "those that are left have their courage much abated, and their countenance is dejected, and they seem as a people affrighted." After a smallpox epidemic, the Cherokee despaired so much that they lost confidence in their gods, and the priests destroyed the sacred objects of the tribe. After all, neither Indians nor pilgrims had access to the germ theory of disease. Indian healers could supply no cure. Their medicines and herbs offered no relief. Their religion provided no explanation. That of the whites did. Like the Europeans 3 centuries before them, many Indians surrendered to alcohol, converted to Christianity, or simply killed themselves. These epidemics probably constituted the most important geopolitical event of the early 17th century. Their net result was that the British, for their first 50 years in New England, would face no real Indian challenge. Indeed, the plague helped prompt the legendarily warm reception Plymouth enjoyed from the Wampanoags. Massasoit, the Wampanoag leader, was eager to ally with the pilgrims because the plague had so weakened his villages that he feared the Narragansetts to the west. When a land conflict did develop between new settlers and old at Saugus in 1631, God ended the controversy by sending the smallpox amongst the Indians, in the words of the Puritan minister, Increase Mather. "Whole towns of them were swept away, in some of them not so much as one soul escaping the destruction." By the time the Indian populations of New England had replenished themselves to some degree, it was too late to expel the intruders. Today, as we compare European technology with that of the primitive Indians, we may conclude that European conquest of America was inevitable, but it did not appear so at the time. The historian Karen Kupperman speculates, "The technology and culture of Indians on America's East Coast were genuine rivals to those of the English, and the eventual outcome of the rivalry was not at first clear. One can only speculate what the outcome of the rivalry would have been if the impact of European diseases on the American population had not been so devastating, if colonists had not been able to occupy lands already cleared by Indian farmers who had vanished. Colonization would have proceeded much more slowly if Indian culture had not been devastated by the physical and psychological assaults it had suffered. Colonization might not have proceeded at all." After all, Native Americans had driven off Samuel de Champlain when he had tried to settle in Massachusetts in 1606. The following year, Abenakis had helped expel the first Plymouth Company settlement from Maine, Alfred Crosby has speculated that the Norse might have succeeded in colonizing Newfoundland and Labrador if they had not had the bad luck to emigrate from Greenland and Iceland, distant from European disease centers. But this is what-if history. The New England plagues were no if. They continued west, racing in advance of the line of culture contact. Everywhere in America, the first European explorers encountered many more Indians than did their successors. A century and a half after Hernando de Soto traveled the southeastern United States, French explorers there found the population less than a quarter of what it had been when de Soto had passed through, with attendant catastrophic effects on native culture and social organization. Likewise, on their famous 1806 expedition, Lewis and Clark encountered far more natives in Oregon than lived there a mere 20 years later. Henry Dobbins has put together a heartbreaking list of 93 epidemics among Native Americans between 1520 and 1918. He has recorded 41 eruptions of smallpox, 4 of bubonic plague, 17 of measles, and 10 of influenza, both often deadly among Native Americans, and 25 of tuberculosis, diphtheria, typhus, cholera, and other diseases. Many of these outbreaks reached truly pandemic proportions, beginning in Florida or Mexico, and stopping only when they reached the Pacific and Arctic oceans. Disease played the same crucial role in Mexico and Peru as it did in Massachusetts. How did the Spanish manage to conquer what is now Mexico City? When the Christians were exhausted from war, God saw fit to send the Indians smallpox, and there was a great pestilence in the city. When the Spanish marched into Tenochtitlan, there were so many bodies that they had to walk on them. Most of the Spaniards were immune to the disease, and that fact itself helped to crush Aztec morale. The pestilence continues today. Miners and loggers have recently introduced European diseases to the Yanomamas of northern Brazil and southern Venezuela, killing a fourth of their total population in 1991. Charles Darwin, writing in 1839, put it almost poetically, "Wherever the European had trod, death seems to pursue the aboriginal." Europeans were never able to settle China, India, Indonesia, Japan, or much of Africa, because too many people already lived there. The crucial role played by the plagues in the Americas can be inferred from two simple population estimates. William McNeill reckons the population of the Americas at 100 million in 1492, while William Langer suggests that Europe had only about 70 million people when Columbus set forth. The Europeans' advantages in military and social technology might have enabled them to dominate the Americas, as they eventually dominated China, India, Indonesia, and Africa, but not to settle the hemisphere. For that, the plague was required. Thus, apart from the European and African invasion itself, the pestilence is surely the most important event in the history of America. The first epidemics wreaked havoc, not only with Indian societies, but also with estimates of pre-Columbian Native American population. The result has been continuing controversy among historians and anthropologists. In 1840, George Catlin estimated Aboriginal numbers in the United States and Canada at the time of white contact to be perhaps 14 million. He believed only 2 million still survived. By 1880, owing to warfare and deculturation as well as illness, native populations had dropped to 250,000, a decline of 98%. In 1921, James Mooney asserted that only 1 million Native Americans had lived in the Americas in 1492. Mooney's estimate was accepted until the 1960s and 1970s, even though the arguments supporting it, based largely on inference rather than evidence, weren't convincing. Colin McAveedy provided an example of the argument. The high rollers, of course, claim that native numbers had been reduced to these low levels, between 1 million and 2 million, by epidemics of smallpox, measles, and other diseases introduced from Europe. And indeed, they could have been. But there's no record of any continental European population being cut back by the sort of percentages needed to get from 20 million to 2 or 1 million. Even the Black Death reduced the population of Europe by only a third. Note that Machiavelli has ignored both the data and also the reasoning about illness summarized above, relying on what amounts to common sense to disprove both. Indeed, he contended, no good can come of affronting common sense. But pre-Pilgrim American epidemiology is not a field of everyday knowledge in which common sense can be allowed to substitute for years of relevant research. By common sense, what Machiavelli really meant was tradition. The American Republic, the authors of The American Pageant tell us on page 1, was from the outset uniquely favored. It started from scratch on a vast and virgin continent, which was so sparsely peopled by Indians that they were able to be eliminated or shouldered aside. Henry Dobbins and Francis Jennings have pointed out that this archetype of the virgin continent and its corollary, the primitive tribe, have subtly influenced estimates of native population. Scholars who viewed Native American cultures as primitive reduced their estimates of pre-contact populations to match the stereotype. The tiny Mooney estimate thus made sense, resonated with the archetype. Never mind that the land was, in reality, not a virgin wilderness, but recently widowed. The very death rates that some historians and geographers now find hard to believe, the Pilgrims knew to be true. For example, William Bradford described how the Dutch, rivals of Plymouth, traveled to an Indian village in Connecticut to trade. But their enterprise failed, for it pleased God to afflict these Indians with such a deadly sickness that out of 1,000, over 950 of them died, and many of them lay rotting above ground for want of burial. This is precisely the 95% mortality that Machiavelli rejected. On the opposite coast, the native population of California sank from 300,000 in 1769, by which time it had already been cut in half by various Spanish-born diseases, to 30,000 a century later, owing mainly to the gold rush, which brought disease, starvation, homicide, and a declining birth rate. For a century after Catlin, historians and anthropologists overlooked the evidence offered by the Pilgrims and other early chroniclers. Beginning with P.M. Ashburn in 1947, however, research has established more accurate estimates based on careful, continent-wide compilations of small-scale studies of first contact and on evidence of early plagues. Most current estimates of the pre-contact population of the United States and Canada range from 10 to 20 million. How did the 12 textbooks, most of which were published in the 1980s, treat this topic? Their authors might let readers in on the furious debate of the 1960s and early 1970s, telling how and why estimates changed. Instead, the textbooks simply state numbers. Very different numbers. As many as 10 million, American Adventures proposes. There were only about 1 million North American Indians, opines the American tradition. Scattered across the North American continent were about 500 different groups, many of them nomadic. Like other Americans who have not studied the literature, the authors of history textbooks are still under the thrall of the virgin land and primitive tribe archetypes. Their most common Indian population estimate is the discredited figure of 1 million, which 5 textbooks supply. Only 2 of the textbooks provide estimates of 10 to 12 million, in the range supported by contemporary scholarship. 2 of the textbooks hedge their bets by suggesting 1 to 12 million, which might reasonably prompt classroom discussion of why estimates are so vague. 3 of the textbooks omit the subject altogether. The problem is not so much the estimates as the attitude. Only one book, The American Adventure, acknowledges that there is a controversy, and this only in a footnote. The other textbooks seem bent on presenting facts for children to learn. Such an approach keeps students ignorant of the reasoning, arguments, and weighing of evidence that go into social science. About the plagues, the textbooks tell even less. Only 3 of the 12 textbooks even mention Indian disease as a factor at Plymouth or anywhere in New England. Life and Liberty does quite a good job. The American Way is the only book that draws the appropriate geopolitical inference about the Plymouth outbreak, but it doesn't discuss any of the other plagues that beset Indians throughout the hemisphere. According to Triumph of the American Nation, if the Pilgrims had arrived at Plymouth a few years earlier, they would have found a busy Indian village surrounded by farmland. As it was, an epidemic had wiped out most of the Indians. Those who survived had abandoned the village. Fortunately for the Pilgrims, Triumph goes on, the cleared fields remained, and a brook of fresh water flowed into the harbor. These 4 sentences exemplify what Michael W. Apple and Linda K. Christian Smith call dominance through mentioning. The passage can hardly offend Pilgrim descendants, yet it gives the publisher deniability. Triumph cannot be accused of omitting the plague, but the sentences bury the plague within a description of the beautiful harbor at Plymouth. Therefore, even though gory details of disease and death are exactly the kinds of things that high school students remember best, the plague won't stick. I know, because I never remembered the plague, and my college textbook mentioned it in a 14-word passage nestled within a paragraph about the Pilgrims' belief in God. In colonial times, everyone knew about the plague. Even before the Mayflower sailed, King James of England gave thanks to Almighty God in his great goodness and bounty toward us for sending us this wonderful plague among the savages. 200 years later, the oldest American history in my collection, J.W. Barber's Interesting Events in the History of the United States, published in 1829, still recalled the plague. A few years before the arrival of the Plymouth settlers, a very mortal sickness raged with great violence among the Indians inhabiting the eastern parts of New England. Whole towns were depopulated. The living were not able to bury the dead, and their bodies were found lying above ground many years after. The Massachusetts Indians are said to have been reduced from 30,000 to 300 fighting men. In 1633, the smallpox swept off great numbers. Today, it's no surprise that not 1 in 100 of my college students has ever heard of the plague. Unless they have read Life and Liberty, students could scarcely come away from these books thinking of Indians as people who made an impact on North America, who lived here in considerable numbers, who settled, in short, and were then killed by disease or arms. Textbook authors have retreated from the candor of Barber. Treatments like that in Triumph guarantee our collective amnesia. Having mistreated the plague, the textbooks proceed to mistreat the Pilgrims. Their arrival in Massachusetts poses another historical controversy the textbook authors take pains to duck. The textbooks say the Pilgrims intended to go to Virginia, where there existed a British settlement already. But the little party on the Mayflower, explains American history, never reached Virginia. On November 9th, they sighted land on Cape Cod. How did the Pilgrims wind up in Massachusetts when they set out for Virginia? Violent storms blew their ship off course, according to some textbooks. Others blame an error in navigation. Both explanations may be wrong. Some historians believe the Dutch bribed the captain of the Mayflower to sail north so Pilgrims wouldn't settle near New Amsterdam. Others hold that the pilgrims went to Cape Cod on purpose. Bear in mind that the pilgrims numbered only about 35 of the 110 settlers aboard the Mayflower. The rest were ordinary folk seeking their fortunes in the new Virginia colony. George Willison has argued that the pilgrim leaders, wanting to be far from Anglican control, never planned to settle in Virginia. They had debated the relative merits of Guyana in South America versus the Massachusetts coast, and, according to Willison, they intended a hijacking. Certainly the pilgrims already knew quite a bit about what Massachusetts could offer them, from the fine fishing along Cape Cod to that wonderful plague which offered an unusual opportunity for British settlement. According to some historians, Squanto, an Indian from the village of Pawtuxet, Massachusetts, had provided Ferdinando Gorges, a leader of the Plymouth Company in England, with a detailed description of the area. Gorges may even have sent Squanto and Captain Thomas Dermer as advance men to wait for the pilgrims, although Dermer sailed away when the pilgrims were delayed in England. In any event, the pilgrims were familiar with the area's topography. Recently published maps that Samuel de Champlain had drawn when he had toured the area in 1605 supplemented the information that had been passed on by 16th-century explorers. John Smith had studied the region and named it New England in 1614, and he even offered to guide the pilgrim leaders. They rejected his services as too expensive and carried his guidebook along instead. These considerations prompt me to believe that the pilgrim leaders probably ended up in Massachusetts on purpose. But evidence for any conclusion is soft. Some historians believe Gorges took credit for landing in Massachusetts after the fact. Indeed, the Mayflower may have had no specific destination. Readers might be fascinated if textbook authors presented two or more of the various possibilities, but, as usual, exposing students to historical controversy is taboo. Each textbook picks just one reason and presents it as fact. Only one of the 12 textbooks adheres to the hijacking possibility. The New England landing came as a rude surprise for the bedraggled and tired non-pilgrim majority on board the Mayflower, says Land of Promise. They had joined the expedition seeking economic opportunity in the Virginia tobacco plantations. Obviously, these passengers weren't happy at having been taken elsewhere, especially to a shore with no prior English settlement to join. Rumors of mutiny spread quickly. Promise then ties this unrest to the Mayflower Compact, giving its readers a fresh interpretation of why the colonists adopted the agreement and why it was so democratic. To avoid rebellion, the pilgrim leaders made a remarkable concession to the other colonists. They issued a call for every male on board, regardless of religion or economic status, to join in the creation of a civil body politic. The compact achieved its purpose. The majority acquiesced. Actually, the hijacking hypothesis doesn't show the pilgrims in such a bad light. The compact provided a graceful solution to an awkward problem. Although hijacking and false representation doubtless were felonies then as now, the colony did survive with a lower death rate than Virginia, so no permanent harm was done. The whole story places the pilgrims in a somewhat dishonorable light, however, which may explain why only one textbook selects it. The navigation error story lacks plausibility. The one parameter of ocean travel that sailors could and did measure accurately in that era was latitude, distance north or south from the equator. The storm's excuse is perhaps still less plausible, for if a storm blew them off course, when the weather cleared, they could have turned southward again, sailing out to sea to bypass any shoals. They had plenty of food and beer, after all. But storms and pilot error leave the pilgrims pure of heart, which may explain why the other 11 textbooks choose one of the two. Regardless of motive, the Mayflower Compact provided a democratic basis for the Plymouth colony. Since the framers of our Constitution in fact paid the compact little heed, however, it hardly deserves the attention textbook's authors lavish on it. But textbook authors clearly want to package the Pilgrims as a pious and moral band who laid the antecedents of our democratic traditions. Nowhere is this motive more embarrassingly obvious than in John Garrity's American History. So far as any record shows, this was the first time in human history that a group of people consciously created a government where none had existed before. Here Garrity paraphrases a Forefathers' Day speech, delivered in Plymouth in 1802, in which John Adams celebrated the only instance in human history of that positive original social compact. George Willison has dryly noted that Adams was blinking several salient facts, above all the circumstances that prompted the compact, which was plainly an instrument of minority rule. Of course, Garrity's paraphrase also exposes his ignorance of the Republic of Iceland, the Iroquois Confederacy, and countless other polities antedating 1620. Such an account simply invites students to become ethnocentric. In their pious treatment of the Pilgrims, history textbooks introduce the archetype of American exceptionalism. According to the American Pageant, "This rare opportunity for a great social and political experiment may never come again." The American Way declares, "The American people have created a unique nation." How is America exceptional? Surely we're exceptionally good. As Woodrow Wilson put it, America is the only idealistic nation in the world. And the goodness started at Plymouth Rock, according to our textbooks, which view the Pilgrims as Christian, sober, democratic, generous to the Indians, God-thanking. Such a happy portrait can be painted only by omitting the facts about the plague, the possible hijacking, and the Indian relations. For that matter, our culture and our textbooks underplay or omit Jamestown and the 16th-century Spanish settlements in favor of Plymouth Rock as the archetypal birthplace of the United States. Virginia, according to T.H. Breen, ill-served later historians in search of the mythic origins of American culture. Historians could hardly tout Virginia as moral in intent. In the words of the first history of Virginia written by a Virginian, "The chief design of all parties concerned was to fetch away the treasure from thence, aiming more at sudden gain than to form any regular colony." The Virginians' relations with the Indians were particularly unsavory. In contrast to Squanto, a volunteer, the British in Virginia took Indian prisoners and forced them to teach colonists how to farm. In 1623, the British indulged in the first use of chemical warfare in the colonies when negotiating a treaty with tribes near the Potomac River, headed by Chiskiak. The British offered a toast symbolizing eternal friendship, whereupon the chief, his family, advisors, and 200 followers dropped dead of poison. Besides, the early Virginians engaged in bickering, sloth, even cannibalism. They spent their early days digging random holes in the ground, haplessly looking for gold instead of planting crops. Soon they were starving and digging up putrid Indian corpses to eat, or renting themselves out to Indian families as servants. Hardly the heroic founders that a great nation requires. Textbooks indeed cover the Virginia colony, and they at least mention the Spanish settlements, but they devote 50% more space to Massachusetts. As a result, and due also to Thanksgiving, of course, students are much more likely to remember the Pilgrims as our founders. They are then embarrassed when I remind them of Virginia and the Spanish, for when prompted, students do recall having heard of both. But neither our culture nor our textbooks give Virginia the same archetypal status as Massachusetts. That's why almost all my students know the name of the Pilgrim ship, while almost no students remember the names of the three ships that brought the British to Jamestown. For the next time you're on Jeopardy, they were the Susan Constant, the Discovery, and the Goodspeed. Despite having ended up many miles from the other European enclaves, the Pilgrims hardly started from scratch in a wilderness. Throughout southern New England, Native Americans had repeatedly burned the underbrush, creating a park-like environment. After landing at Provincetown, the Pilgrims assembled a boat for exploring and began looking around for their new home. They chose Plymouth because of its beautifully cleared fields, recently planted in corn, and its useful harbor and brook of fresh water. It was a lovely sight for a town. Indeed, until the plague, it had been a town. For New Plymouth was none other than Squanto's village of Pawtuxet. The invaders followed a pattern. Throughout the hemisphere, Europeans pitched camp right in the middle of native populations. Cusco, Mexico City, Natchez, Chicago. Throughout New England, colonists appropriated Indian cornfields for their initial settlements, avoiding the back-breaking labor of clearing the land of forest and rock. This explains why, to this day, the names of so many towns throughout the region, Marshfield, Springfield, Deerfield, end in field. Errand into the Wilderness may have made a lively sermon title in 1650, a popular book title in 1950, and an archetypal textbook phrase in 1990, but it was never accurate. The new settlers encountered no wilderness. "In this bay wherein we live," one colonist noted in 1622, "in former time hath lived about 2,000 Indians." Moreover, not all the native inhabitants had perished, and the survivors now facilitated British settlement. The Pilgrims began receiving Indian assistance on their second full day in Massachusetts. A colonist journal tells of sailors discovering two Indian houses. "Having their guns and hearing nobody, they entered the houses and found the people were gone. The sailors took some things but didn't dare stay. We had meant to have left some beads and other things in the houses as a sign of peace, and to show we meant to trade with them, but we didn't do it because we left in such haste. But as soon as we can meet with the Indians, we will pay them for what we took." It wasn't only houses that the Pilgrims robbed. Our eyewitness resumes his story. "We marched to the place we called Cornhill, where we had found the corn before. At another place we had seen before, we dug and found some more corn, two or three baskets full, and a bag of beans. In all, we had about 10 bushels, which will be enough for seed. It was with God's help that we found this corn, for how else could we have done it without meeting some Indians who might trouble us?" From the start, the Pilgrims thanked God, not the Indians, for assistance that the latter had inadvertently provided, setting a pattern for later thanksgivings. Our journalist continues, "The next morning we found a place like a grave. We decided to dig it up. We found first a mat, and under that a fine bow. We also found bowls, trays, dishes, and things like that. We took several of the prettiest things to carry away with us, and covered the body up again." A place like a grave? Although Karen Kupperman says the Pilgrims continued to rob graves for years, more help came from a live Indian, Squanto. Here my students return to familiar turf, for they have all learned the Squanto legend. Land of Promise provides a typical account. "Squanto had learned their language," he explained, "from English fishermen who ventured into the New England waters each summer. Squanto taught the Pilgrims how to plant corn, squash, and pumpkins. Would the small band of settlers have survived without Squanto's help? We cannot say. But by the fall of 1621, colonists and Indians could sit down to several days of feast and thanksgiving to God, later celebrated as the first Thanksgiving." What do the books leave out about Squanto? First, how he learned English. According to Ferdinando Gorges, around 1605 a British captain stole Squanto, who was then still a boy, along with 4 Penobscots, and then took them to England. There Squanto spent 9 years, 3 in the employ of Gorges. At length, Gorges helped Squanto arrange passage back to Massachusetts. Some historians doubt that Squanto was among the 5 Indians stolen in 1605. All sources agree, however, that in 1614, a British slave raider seized Squanto and 2 dozen fellow Indians and sold them into slavery in Malaga, Spain. What happened next makes Ulysses look like a homebody. Squanto escaped from slavery, escaped from Spain, and made his way back to England. After trying to get home via Newfoundland, in 1619 he talked Thomas Dermer into taking him along on his next trip to Cape Cod. It happens that Squanto's fabulous odyssey provides a hook into the plague story, a hook that our textbooks choose not to use. For now, Squanto set foot again on Massachusetts soil and walked to his home village of Pawtuxet, only to make the horrifying discovery that he was the sole member of his village still alive. All the others had perished in the epidemic 2 years before. No wonder Squanto threw in his lot with the pilgrims. Now that is a story worth telling. Compare the pallid account in Land of Promise. He had learned their language from English fishermen. As translator, ambassador, and technical advisor, Squanto was essential to the survival of Plymouth in its first 2 years. Like other Europeans in America, the pilgrims had no idea what to eat or how to raise or find it until Indians showed them. William Bradford called Squanto a special instrument sent of God for their good beyond their expectation. He directed them how to set their corn, where to take fish, and to procure other commodities, and was also their pilot to bring them to unknown places for their profit. Squanto wasn't the pilgrims' only aid. In the summer of 1621, Massasoit sent another Indian, Hobomok, to live among the pilgrims for several years as guide and ambassador. Their profit was the primary reason most Mayflower colonists made the trip. As Robert Morris pointed out, textbooks neglect to analyze the profit motive underlying much of our history. Profit, too, came from the Indians, by way of the fur trade, without which Plymouth would never have paid for itself. Hobomok helped Plymouth set up fur trading posts at the mouth of the Penobscot and Kennebec Rivers in Maine, in Aptuxet, Massachusetts, and in Windsor, Connecticut. Europeans had neither the skill nor the desire to go boldly where none dared go before. They went to the Indians. All this brings us to Thanksgiving. Throughout the nation every fall, elementary school children reenact a little morality play, the first Thanksgiving, as our national origin myth, complete with pilgrim hats made out of construction paper and Indian braves with feathers in their hair. Thanksgiving is the occasion on which we give thanks to God as a nation for the blessings that He hath bestowed upon us. More than any other celebration, even more than such overtly patriotic holidays as Independence Day and Memorial Day, Thanksgiving celebrates our ethnocentrism. We have seen, for example, how King James and the early pilgrim leaders gave thanks for the plague, which proved to them that God was on our side. Archetypes associated with Thanksgiving, God on our side, civilization wrested from wilderness, order from disorder, through hard work and good pilgrim character traits, continue to radiate from our history textbooks. More than 60 years ago, in an analysis of how American history was taught in the 1920s, Bessie Pierce pointed out the political use to which Thanksgiving is put. For these unexcelled blessings, the pupil is urged to follow in the footsteps of his forebears, to offer unquestioning obedience to the law of the land, and to carry on the work begun. Thanksgiving dinner is a ritual, with all the characteristics that Mircea Eliade assigns to the ritual observances of original myths. 1. It constitutes the history of the acts of the founders, the supernaturals.